stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama has arrived in Ethiopia for 2 days of talks focused on terrorism, human rights, and civil war in South Sudan. The president was welcomed Sunday at the Addis Ababa airport by the Ethiopian prime minister and taken to the U.S. embassy. Before Ethiopia, Mr. Obama spent 2 days in his father's homeland of Kenya. In a speech before his departure, he said Kenya is at a crossroads.
I want to say particularly to the young people here today, Kenya is on the move. Africa is on the move. You are poised to play a bigger role in this world as the shadows of the past are replaced by the light that you offer an increasingly interconnected world. And in the light of this new day, we have to learn to see ourselves and one another. We have to see that we are connected. Our fates are bound together.
This is the first time a sitting U.S. president has visited Ethiopia. Monday, Mr. Obama is scheduled to hold bilateral talks with Ethiopian leaders and convene a meeting of East African heads of state. On Tuesday, Mr. Obama makes a visit to the African Union headquarters in Addis before beginning his flight home to Washington. At least 100 Afghan police and border officers have defected to the Taliban and the largest mass surrender since the United States and NATO forces ended their combat mission at the end of last year. The Afghan security forces surrendered late Saturday after clashing with Taliban fighters for 3 days at the Taragan base in Badakhshan province. It's in the remote part of the country. The local police commander was among those who defected, turning over the base's weapons and ammunition. VOA News. At least 13 people were killed in Somalia's capital Sunday when a car bomb exploded outside a hotel that hosts the Chinese and Egyptian embassies. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the blast that targeted the Hotel Jazeera near Mogadishu's international airport. The hotel is often used by members of parliament, journalists, as well as foreign diplomats. The death toll comes from ambulance services who say they also took more than 20 people who were wounded to hospitals. There's no immediate word on the nationalities of those injured or killed. Israeli police clashed Sunday with Palestinian protesters at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. As Jews visited the site, they revere as a Temple Mount on an annual day of mourning. Palestinians threw stones and fireworks at Israeli authorities as police fired stun grenades to quell the protest in Jerusalem's Old City. Security forces briefly entered the mosque to restore calm and lock the demonstrators inside. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned Israeli authorities for what they said were provocative visits by devout Jews to the site. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has delivered a defiant speech on state television Sunday, insisting that while the Syrian army has had to pull back from certain regions for strategic reasons, the government would ultimately prevail. Edward Uranian reports.
The crowd applauded as President Bashar al-Assad described the conflict in Syria as an existential battle against terrorists and outside armies supported by powerful regional and international states. He insisted Syria has not and will not give in to outside pressure.
فالدول المتمسكة بحقوقها لابد وأن تنتصر.
He said countries that stand up for their rights ultimately go on to win their battles. The speech, carried live on Syrian state TV, was repeatedly scrambled by hackers, making parts of it barely intelligible. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Intense fighting erupted Sunday in Yemen for control of the country's largest airbase, with the Houthi leader rejecting a call from the Saudi-led Arab coalition fighting the insurgents for a 5-day humanitarian truce. The Houthi chief said a ceasefire would only benefit the Islamic State and al-Qaeda militants. An explosion set off by a female suicide bomber has killed at least 14 people at a market in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say around 50 people were also injured. Officials say the early day blast occurred at the entrance of the market in the town of Domoturu, the capital of Yobe State. No one has claimed responsibility for that attack. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The president shall see whether the development of Ethiopia is real or not, or whether the government is true or the oppositors true.
President Barack Obama's first state visit to Ethiopia is met with excitement and caution.
A free and fair election will provide a good basis for both stability and subsequent development of the country.
Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda promises transparent and credible elections next year.
As civil society organizations, we have stated very clearly that the president of Burundi will be respected and treated as our president.
And a Burundian civil society leader welcomes the international community's rejection of President Pierre Nkurunziza's re-election victory. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Barack Obama's first state visit to Ethiopia is being met with excitement and caution. Critics of the Ethiopian government say the increasingly authoritarian regime has stifled free expression, something VOA News' Anita Powell discovered as she tried to find out what ordinary Ethiopians hope to see from Mr. Obama's visit.
Guns far outnumber American flags on the streets of Addis Ababa as U.S. President Barack Obama prepares to make a state visit. Federal policemen bearing AK-47s are stationed every few meters on many of the Ethiopian capital's major roads. And Addis Ababa police have set up roadblocks for vehicle searches and pat-downs of drivers and passengers. This attention to security has made Ethiopia a close ally of the United States in fighting terrorism in East Africa. While Somalia's Al-Shabaab extremist group has struck in neighboring Kenya and as far as Uganda, Ethiopia has kept the extremists from reaching over its border. Earlier this month, witnesses in Somalia said 3,000 Ethiopian troops entered Somalia, reportedly to target the extremist group. Some critics of the government, among them about a dozen imprisoned journalists and bloggers, say this security often comes at the expense of their civil liberties and human rights. The U.S. State Department lists several concerns in its human rights report on Ethiopia, from restrictions on freedom of expression and freedom of association to harassment and intimidation of opposition members and journalists, and even alleged arbitrary killings, alleged torture, beating, abuse, and mistreatment of detainees by security forces. But Ethiopia has also gained praise for its rapid double-digit economic growth and for its efficient use of international donor funds. Those topics will also dominate Mr. Obama's discussions with his counterpart, Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn. Many residents of Addis Ababa, when approached by VOA, said they had no opinion on Mr. Obama's visit. Some say they are disappointed in Mr. Obama, a common refrain in Africa where many say they expected more from the first American president of African origin. But others say they are hopeful about his visit. Information technology manager Samson Kiflum said more cooperation with the American IT industry would be nice. But his biggest wish?
Maybe better freedom. Not technology, actually better freedom. Yeah.
Bank employee Malaku Alameru echoed many people concerned Mr. Obama's carefully choreographed trip would shield him from the often harsh realities of life for many Ethiopians.
The president shall see whether the development of Ethiopia is real or not, or whether the government is true or the oppositors true. The government is saying that human rights are respected, and the oppositors are saying that not respected. Rather, the government is denying the human rights of Ethiopia.
After speaking to Malaku, VOA was ordered by Addis Ababa police to stop filming and immediately leave the area. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Meanwhile, there's no limit to what you can achieve. That was U.S. President Barack Obama's message to Kenya's youth. VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey has more on Mr. Obama's speech Sunday in Nairobi.
I am proud to be the first American president to come to Kenya. And of course, I'm the first Kenyan-American to be president of the United States.
With that rousing reception, this son of a Kenyan father ended his historic visit to the West African nation with a call to the country's youth to continue on an arc of progress that sheds the corruption, cronyism, and tribalism of the past. But that progress, President Obama told a stadium packed with 4,000 students, must be built on a society free of corruption, respect for opposing voices, and unity.
I want to be very clear here. A politics that's based solely on tribe and ethnicity is a politics that's doomed to tear a country apart. It is a failure of imagination.
Mr. Obama's remarks come as Kenyan authorities are accused of unfairly targeting its Muslim minority and ethnic Somali population in the fight against the Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab. The U.S. leader said he was in Kenya as a friend, wanting the nation to succeed based on strong democratic governance, opportunity for all people, and a sense of national identity that rejects conflict.
Progress requires that you honestly confront the dark corners of our own past. Extend rights and opportunities to more of your citizens. See the differences and diversity of this country as a strength, just as we in America try to see the diversity of our country as a strength and not a weakness.
Mr. Obama drew more cheers and applause when he spoke passionately against so-called old traditions that repress women and girls.
Treating women as second-class citizens is a bad tradition. It holds you back. There's no excuse for sexual assault or domestic violence. There's no reason that young girls should suffer genital mutilation. There's no place in civilized society for the early or forced marriage of children. These traditions may date back centuries. They have no place in the 21st century.
Those words and the president's call to educate girls and employ women resonated with Daystar University student Emmy Gashini.
It made me feel amazing because that is, as a woman, that is what I want to hear. Because one day maybe I want to be in politics, and because of these rules and stereotypes that we have in Africa, we can't be able to get this seat. Yeah.
Incredible and motivating were words 21-year-old Grace Karuru used to describe Mr. Obama's speech at the Safaricom Stadium in Nairobi.
We are also people who can do big, big things, and the fact that he is the president of America makes us very proud and very motivated.
A son of a Kenyan father who was elected president of the United States on a message of hope, bringing that same message to the next generation of Kenya. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda is pledging that next year's elections will be free and democratic, but opposition and civil society groups have accused the government of using security forces to harass potential challengers to President Yoweri Museveni. The Electoral Commission recently released a voters list it compiled to allow eligible voters to verify their information on the register. Opposition groups say the list should be scrapped for a fresh one, accusing the electoral body of lacking transparency in the process.
The people of Uganda should expect a free, peaceful, and democratic election that will give them their leaders from the president, parliament, district level, and at the grassroots.
Critics of the government say that the government has not been too interested in the constitutional provision which calls for freedom of association and freedom of the press, and that opposition forces are not necessarily given the freedom to operate in a democratic space in Uganda. What do you say to such critics, Mr. Prime Minister?
The policy is to ensure that there is proper access by intending candidates at different levels to the electorate, to their voters. And in this respect, there are laws that govern meetings around this time of elections. And all we are saying is that these laws should be respected by the candidates when they are consulting with the population.
The Independent Electoral Commission is compiling a voters list that will be used for next year's election. Has the government given them all they need to give them in order to prepare adequately for the election? And how credible do you think the voter and transparent do you think the voter list is going to be that will be used for the election?
Without any doubt, this is going to be the best voters register ever produced in Uganda. It will have not only photographs, but other biometric parameters that can be used to ensure that the voter is indeed the voter and nobody is trying to carry out fraud around the elections. So the register, without any doubt, is going to be the best we have produced so far. And we believe that with a good register, you have laid a good foundation for a free and fair election.
Regionally, Uganda has played a very critical role in trying to bring opposing forces in Burundi together. The election, presidential election, was recently held. As a big brother in the neighborhood, what is Uganda's stance on the election, and what is Uganda's message to the people of Burundi?
Uganda and the region, East African region, and I believe the international community would like to see a peaceful resolution of some of the issues that have caused the tension in Burundi. And as you know, the region elected or appointed President Yoweri Museveni to be brokering the peace in Burundi. He has energetically started his work, and he is being assisted by the Minister of Defense of Uganda. And we believe that the peace process is central on course. We would like to see the Burundi resolve their issues and sort out their house with the support of the region and the international community.
Well, I know you're busy, Mr. Prime Minister, so I'm not going to keep you. But what will be your message to the people of Uganda ahead of next year's election?
The message to the people of Uganda is that they should all be prepared to fully participate in the forthcoming elections early next year, either as candidates at different levels or as voters, and that all of us, the people of Uganda, should work for and ensure a free and a fair election, because a free and fair election will provide a good basis for both stability and subsequent development of the country.
Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda is the Ugandan Prime Minister. He spoke with me from the UN headquarters in New York. The Chief Executive Officer of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society in Burundi says President Pierre Nkurunziza should not be part of any unity government. Vital Nshimirimane's remarks follow violent unrest in Burundi since Mr. Nkurunziza announced he would run for a third term. Critics charge an Nkurunziza third term violates the constitution as well as the Arusha Accord that ended a civil war. Nshimirimane told me earlier that he welcomes the international community's rejection of the outcome of the presidential election, which Mr. Nkurunziza won.
Actually, civil society organizations released a communique where they state that they have not been an election as such, since there is an unconstitutional and illegal candidate who ran alone. Second, we have noticed that this said and the fake election was held in a kind of environment where security requirements were not met. They had not been the disarmament of the ruling party's militia in Mbonerakure, which is spreading fear in the country.
Well, they are saying that some opposition groups participated in the election, so this election is legitimate, although the international community appears not to accept the results of the poll. What is going to happen next in Burundi?
As civil society organizations, we have started very clearly that the president of Burundi will be respected and treated as our president up to date of 26 August this year, because he has been elected for his second and last term of office. And beyond that date, he will no longer be our president. He will just be an ordinary citizen, and he does not deserve regards from the people.
Some opposition groups are calling for fresh elections, but how can you call for fresh elections when the elections have been held, some people participated in it, and you are saying that Burundians will not respect him as the legitimate president? Then what is going to happen?
Actually, Burundians have experienced very, very bad crisis in the past, and the Burundians seated together and found out their a solution, which was laid down in the Arusha Agreement. Now that Burundian has found a solution for their conflict, for a very clear conflict, which was led by the exclusion, which was happening at that time, this time it is even easier to find a solution caused by a conflict, caused by the ambition of one man wanted to run against the will of the people.
Some people have called for a unity government with the CNDD-FDD with regards to President Nkurunziza still being part of the government. What is your take on that?
A power-sharing policy is the one, the leading word, the key word in the Arusha Peace Agreement and in the Constitution as well, which is said quotas for the ethnic groups, 60% for the Hutu, 40% for the Tutsi in the institutions. So a government of national unity cannot go beyond or below what is stated in the Arusha Peace Agreement in the Constitution, and the government of national unity cannot go with President Nkurunziza as a member of the government of that said government.
Why not?
He cannot, because once since he have decided to break the consensus, the Burundian consensus that put an end to a deadly conflict that cost 3,100 Burundian deaths, this means that he does not deserve to be at that bench. He has lost his legitimacy to be part of the Burundian political stakeholders since he decided to break all what Burundian has built over the years.
Vital Nshimarimana is the chief executive officer of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society in Burundi. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The leader of a U.S.-based Ethiopian opposition group has reportedly relocated to Eritrea to organize civil and armed resistance against the government in Addis Ababa. Berhanu Nege's travel to Eritrea follows the measure of his Gimbot 7 group with the Ethiopian People's Patriotic Front this year. Tedese Biro is the spokesperson of Gimbot 7. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in London to confirm this development.
True, he traveled there. Yes, that's true.
When did he move? Do you know?
Yeah, on July 17th.
What's the primary purpose of his moving to Eritrea?
He is the leader of Patriotic Gimbot 7 Movement for Unity and Democracy. It is an organization, a movement that strives to bring about democratic order in Ethiopia. And he's a leader, and he's a chairman of that organization, and he went to fulfill his leadership role.
This group merged with the Ethiopian People's Patriotic Front. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
There are reports that he's going to organize both armed resistance against the government in Addis Ababa. Is that correct too?
Well, we do have a kind of blended strategy to just challenge the government in Addis Ababa. We have been trying to stage civic disobedience. We tried the peaceful resistance, peaceful opposition in Ethiopia in starting from 2005. probably you know that the story starts from 2012 national election. And after that, the peaceful way, the peaceful means that are already closed by the government of Ethiopia. And we are forced to consider all possible avenues, including civic disobedience and some stage that is armed resistance as well, a kind of blended strategy. But we are always open for possibilities of peaceful resolution. And we have been trying to, the movement itself emerged from the peaceful movement. But now we are forced to consider, this is not our choice, but there is no other feasible option to challenge the government in Addis Ababa.
So in other words, you're going to be blending peaceful resistance with non-peaceful resistance, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. And then that is, we want to organize civic disobedience, that is of the peaceful resistance, but it should be supported by non-peaceful resistance, like it has been done in South Africa for itself.
What does this move mean for the relationship between Ethiopia and Eritrea, since Mr. Negu will be based in Eritrea?
Nothing special will happen, that the relationship between the two countries was not friendly, as we know. The only thing is that Eritrea has provided us the possibility to organize our movement there, that is all. And I don't think that it will affect in any way the relationship. But it has been, the relationship was not good so far, and it will not make any difference, I think.
Officials in Addis Ababa have described your group as militarily weak, and that the move of Mr. Negu to Eritrea is a publicity stunt. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the government in Ethiopia says many things, and this is one of the many statements that the government has been providing. I don't think that this is in any way credible, and what the government in Ethiopia say cannot be taken as any credible statement, because they have been naming and they have been labeling us in whatever way they want, and this is simply one of the namings and labeling strategy.
You talk of combining, blending these methods. Do you have a fighting force?
Yes. There is a small group that has been taking training in Eritrea, and there is a movement developing that is developing day by day.
Tadesse Beru is the spokesperson for the Ethiopia opposition group Gimbot 7. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Ipuga from London.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shumari and his guest discussing obesity, an issue of concern all over the world. This lighthearted show also covers topics that are important to you. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. So we hope you tune in.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the controversial presidential election in Burundi as Nkurunziza is set to win a third term, and on the ongoing process of lifting presidential term limits in Rwanda that will allow President Kagame to run again. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, July 26th. The top 13-ranked African football nations got a boost on Saturday when the draw for the 2018 World Cup qualifiers was made in Russia. Each of the countries gets a first-round bye before facing one of the weaker national teams on the continent in the second round in November. Victories in the home and away ties will secure places in the 20-nation third round, from which the five group winners qualify for the World Cup to be hosted by Russia. Algeria is Africa's top-ranked team. The other 12 in that order are Ivory Coast, Ghana, Tunisia, Senegal, Cameroon, Congo, Cape Verde, Egypt, Nigeria, Guinea, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Mali. In the first round of the African qualifiers in October 2015, the 26th lowest-ranked African sides in the FIFA rankings play each other in two legs. Meanwhile, South Africa was handed a tough task when the draw was made. Bafana Bafana, which has played in the Global Football Showcase three times, was paired with fellow Southern African team Angola. It is the only one of 20 second-round ties featuring two former qualifiers, as Angola participated in the 2006 tournament. Here now are some of the other highlights of the African draw. Cameroon will start campaigning for a record-extending eighth appearance by an African team with an away game against Somalia or Niger. Nigeria, the second most frequent African qualifier, looks set to tackle Swaziland, African Cup of Nations title holder Ivory Coast, and Ghana, the team it defeated on penalties in the final last February, are chasing fourth consecutive World Cup appearances. The Ivorians begin with a visit to Liberia or Guinea-Bissau, while Ghana travels to the Comoros Islands or Lesotho. Highest-ranked African team Algeria, which took eventual 2014 World Champion Germany to extra time in a last 16 clash in Brazil, plays Tanzania or Malawi. Egypt, winner of the Cup of Nations a record seven times, but repeated World Cup qualifying flop, was drawn against Chad or Sierra Leone. Debutant South Sudan faces Mauritania, and Mauritius plays Kenya in the first round. Zimbabwe is the only one of the 54 Confederation of African Football members who did not take part in the draw. Staying with the 2018 World Cup, despite FIFA scandals, beleaguered President Sepp Blatter says the organization remains committed to 2018 World Cup host nation Russia. During a meeting Saturday with Russian President Vladimir Putin ahead of the qualifying draw, the FIFA president told Putin that, quote, "We say yes to Russia. We are providing our support," unquote. Turning to African club football news, match day three games were played in Group A of the African Confederation Cup on Saturday. At the end, Egyptian giant Al Ahly goes top of the group on 7 points, followed by Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia on 6. Stade Malien of Mali is third on 4 points, while Esperance of Tunisia is at the bottom, without a point after three matches. In the African Champions League, title holder AS Setif of Algeria was held to a 1-1 draw by Al Merrikh of Sudan in their Group B match day three clash on Saturday in Setif. That means the defending champions have gone 540 minutes without a home win at the group phase of the competition. Another Algerian team, USM Alger, was more fortunate, beating MC Yulma, also of Algeria, 2-1. After three matches, USM leads Group B on the maximum 9 points. Al Merrikh and AS Setif are next on 4 points each way, even though the Sudanese club has a superior goal differential. MC Yulma, in the meantime, is at the bottom without a point. In the only Group A day three match played on Saturday in the Champions League, TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo traveled to Egypt to beat home team Smuha 2-0. TP Mazembe tops the group on 5 points, while Smuha is third on 3, one behind Al Hilal of Sudan. Finally, this weekend, Algeria has become the first team to qualify for the 2015 African Under-23 Championship to be hosted by Senegal. A barren draw against Sierra Leone in the third round return leg match on Saturday in Blida, Algeria, got the North Africans the enviable tag of the first side to confirm their place for the African qualifiers for the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. The remaining six places in the African Under-23 Championship finals will be decided next weekend. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
beat ya bawa.
Oh na na na, oh na na na. Baby basi juu tu ni kitu nani kashuma. It's time.
Mr. Flavor, oh, nah, nah.
If we remember, baby.
Oh my lover,
Jambore,
ah,
Wakabi,
eh,
I give to you everything you need. You know go suffer, we go jolly. I get you plenty, plenty money. From Kampala, take you to Lagos, anywhere you want go. Eddie Kenzo, KC, flexing and shopping, baby, come on, let's go.
Holy pa, shake it, roll in my baby movie. Holy pa, shake it, roll in my baby movie.
Hey, Maleo, taba some pezwe.
Oh, no wanga susekal. Maswaka swaka ngabi ya sekali. Ono wanga su sekali. Hapana na Kim Kardashian. Oh my lover.
Jambore. Wakabi.
Hey my lover.
Jambore.
Oh.
Wakabi.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Hey my lover.
Wakabi.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Ina waka misi.
Wakabi.
Hey maleyo.
Jambore.
Taba sampezu.
Wakabi.
Yeah.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As President Obama visits the country of his father, security became a very major concern. In that connection, UNISOM, the UN-backed peacekeeping force in Somalia, launched two major operations against Al-Shabaab. But as in the past, Al-Shabaab withdrew from those areas before the arrival of the peacekeeping force. And this created the illusion that Al-Shabaab had been defeated. But we have known, as in the past, that Al-Shabaab had returned with a vengeance. Now, the government announced after the operation that they would offer armistice to all those opposed to the government. While this is a good idea, it does not go far enough. One cannot expect stable peace in Somalia unless there is an accommodation with all of the opponents of the government. And thus far, not much has been done either by the United Nations, the African Union, and the regional powers to try to resolve the political factors that may maintain the survival of Al-Shabaab. We know that in Kenya, where President Obama is visiting, that the impact of Al-Shabaab is very important. So one would hope that the possibility of negotiations with those elements of Al-Shabaab will be taken up anew. But we also noticed last week how far Africa has fallen in its role toward democracy. In Burundi, President Nkurunziza and his supporters have been able to violate every principles of democracy in the pursuit for a third term. They manipulated the courts to affirm that the third term is not in contravention of negotiations. Secondly, the Electoral Commission has not been able to function as was intended. Therefore, it is not surprising that the results showed that President Nkurunziza won by 70%. This is a complete farce. What the African Union, United Nations, and others should have done is to produce a red line. No one should be able to accept the legitimacy of the current government of Burundi. They should not be allowed to participate in any meetings of the African Union. And also, the African Union and its supporters could challenge the credential of the Nkurunziza government that has now been elected in violation of democratic principles. Only these kinds of red lines would show to the president of Burundi that he could not bulldoze his way to a third term. Of course, it will not be an easy process. There are many governments in Africa who do not believe in the limitation of a third term. But unless a stop is made, we will find more and more leaders following the path of Burundi. So these are the areas where I think African Union should pursue. And hopefully, when President Obama visits Ethiopia and visits the headquarters of African Union, this matter could be taken up in their consultations. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you eat the fruit of a big tree, don't forget to thank the wind. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIL is traumatizing a whole generation of Iraqi and Syrian children by subjecting them to violence and slavery. Many of these children have witnessed unimaginable violence, seen loved ones killed and homes destroyed. As a result, many are showing signs of severe trauma and depression that they will carry with them for many years to come. ISIL, also known as Daesh, has kidnapped nearly 500 children to be used as suicide bombers and child soldiers, and it has threatened families, forcing them to give up their boys to fight with Daesh. In 2015 alone, Daesh has trained more than 400 children in Syria, calling them cubs of the caliphate. Children receive intense military and religious training during which they are forced to perform brutal acts and brainwashed to eliminate empathy for ISIL's victims. Currently, some 600 children younger than age 13 are patrolling the streets of Mosul, the second largest city of Iraq. Several months ago, at the Palmyra Roman Amphitheater in Syria, Daesh forced innocent children to brutally slaughter a group of Syrian regime soldiers in front of an audience and produced a video of the execution. Daesh directs much of its propaganda at mothers, instructing them to raise their sons and daughters in the fold of Islamic extremism. A guidebook published by Daesh praises female Islamic fighters as a way to encourage girls to fight. It prints bedtime stories about martyrdom and heroic jihadists. It also encourages children to watch violent videos of Islamic State battles and beheadings in an effort to desensitize them. But most of the Arab world is not deceived by Daesh and openly abhors what it stands for. As a recent parody of a Daesh slogan in Arabic makes clear, "My dear Muslim brothers and sisters, do you know to whom the word Daesh refers? To everyone who kills, rapes, dishonors women, steals money, displaces people, recruits child soldiers, and commits ethnic and religious cleansing. The brutality of Daesh toward children, women, Christians, Yazidis, and Shia must be stopped."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.